This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, according to a survey, more than half of Illinoisans believe there's a better understanding of sexual harassment and that those accused of harassment are more likely to be held accountable. But what else do the numbers show? We'll talk with one of the organizers of the survey. The state's new marijuana law promises equity in the industry, but not everyone is sure that will happen. Illinois' crime lab has a massive backlog of DNA evidence submitted for testing. One of the reasons is how much evidence comes in.
What you have are crime scene investigators literally collecting every piece of debris. So if a crime happens in an alley, they're collecting every cigarette butt, every napkin. They're collecting every piece of trash around the area.
And we'll venture into a pro wrestling ring right here in Illinois. You might be surprised at what it takes to put on the entertainment spectacle. That and more on this week's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll look at some of the reasons why Illinois' crime lab is so far behind when it comes to DNA testing. And an author and professor gets the lowdown on pro wrestling right here in Illinois. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. The new law to allow recreational marijuana use in Illinois is unprecedented in the U.S. It addresses racial equity and also seeks to reverse some of the harm done to black and brown communities during the war on drugs. Advocates say now the work begins to make sure the promises are kept and to make sure some of the people left out of the law are added in. Natalie Moore brings us the story.
It's a hot Friday afternoon. The intersection of Madison and Pulaski on Chicago's west side is lively. Alonzo Wahid offers up free slices of pizza as he talks to a passerby through a gate. The underground economy thrives here, where jobs are scarce. The selling of loose cigarettes, DVDs, weed.
With an individual out here selling socks, braiding hair, or just doing whatever it is they need to do to hustle, if someone comes in and take that job away from them, then how do they survive now? So what we're really talking about is a labor dispute.
A labor dispute is Wahid's take on how these corners will be affected with the legalization of marijuana. What happens to drug dealers?
I get what he's saying.
But at the same time,
basically, he's saying they way of selling weed
at
stuff
the same
is to basically
time,
live.
Why won't y'all just...
Wahid is a lead organizer with Equity and Transformation, or EAT. The group was part of a coalition pushing for fairness in the marijuana bill. Historical criminal justice reforms are underfoot that take effect in January. Among them, some people convicted of marijuana possession will have their cases expunged. The amounts of possession are minor, yet hundreds of thousands are expected to get relief, an unmatched effort nationally. And a $30 million business development fund will help applicants living in areas impacted by the war on cannabis who want a cannabis license. Richard Wallace of EAT is out here organizing too with Wahid.
But there also are components of the bill that do not ensure equity, specifically for like formerly incarcerated people.
And that's the thing that I have the big issue with. It was good enough to lock these individuals up. It was good enough to wage a war on them. But now over here on this side, we're going to allow individuals to come and do the exact thing that they were doing, right? But the individual that we locked up, they're now ineligible to even sell it. They're now ineligible to even make a profit from it.
Wahid and Wallace were both incarcerated. Wahid for selling drugs.
I ended up selling drugs, ended up working in selling drugs in different communities because that was a way for me to survive, to take care of myself, to take care of my family. It started with me around the age of about between the ages of 8 and 10 years old. So I then became the head of my household at that time. My mother couldn't do it. My father has passed away. While my mother was hooked on drugs, I had to figure out now what did I need to do to take care of the family. And so I didn't have no childhood. It was straight adulthood.
Neither one of them would qualify for a cannabis license because of their felonies. Neither wants one, but that's beside the point.
Do you want an amendment? How do you get the change that you want?
Now is organizing a community, galvanizing them, and saying, hey, this is what we need to fight for. So, yes, it's a time to celebrate, but it's also a time to educate, and it's also a time to inform.
We need formerly incarcerated and informal workers to see the process through.
Who are your allies in positions of power?
Tori Hutchison has been a strong ally.
Their efforts to keep shining a light on all of those things absolutely need to keep happening.
That's Democratic State Senator Toy Hutchinson.
People need to actually have real conversations about the honesty of what we're talking about. If we are legalizing the ability for people in suits to sell metric tons of this, and you have people who still have things on their record for the exact same activity. So they're not wrong in that at all.
She says passing the bill is the first step in a long journey.
That rollout happens, and it doesn't diversify the industry as much as we want to, then we put a lid on the market, we slow it down, we're doing a disparity study so that we can give ourselves the time to self-correct and course correct.
Cannabis legalization isn't just about smoking or selling weed legally.
So you are on the Inglewood Trail, the Inglewood line, which is a 2-mile-long nature trail in the middle of Inglewood that we're developing.
Anton Seals is executive director of Grow Greater Inglewood. This Southside neighborhood is certainly one affected by the war on drugs and could benefit from social equity in the new law. Inglewood has become a hotbed for urban agriculture in Chicago.
There's so much talk about the economic kind of improvements, the kind of justice improvements. There's also the kind of efficacy of the growing of the plant itself. They need to be tended and nurtured. And that is something that, as stewards of the earth, that's something that African-American that we want our people to tap back into.
Kenya and Julian Sample are a husband and wife team engaged in urban agriculture. They also own DuSable City Ancestral Winery and Vineyards and are interested in a cannabis ingredient that doesn't get you high and is supposed to help with healing.
We would love to have a CBD-infused wine. Then we're very interested in the textile industry.
Hemp dog collars, hemp wine stoppers. You can develop hemp clothing brands.
Feminine products.
Yeah.
Hemp became legal in Illinois last year.
Deodorant.
This new legal marijuana industry is a boon with many possibilities. According to some estimates, the industry will top more than $65 billion nationwide by 2025. And people in Illinois will literally watch it grow before their eyes while keeping the focus on racial justice. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
While high school students are increasingly packing their schedules with honors courses and electives, that means something has to give during the school day. And as St. Louis Public Radio's Ryan Delaney reports, more teens are now taking PE from home over the summer.
Nora Pryor is Lapping Boulevard Park in Lake St. Louis. The 15-year-old mixes speed walking and jogging on the hot summer morning to get her heart rate up, occasionally glancing down at her Garmin fitness tracker.
I'm at 137 right now, which is like perfectly right in the middle of the zone that I have to be in. So we're getting up there.
In addition to 7 hours of exercise a week for her online gym class, she completes digital assignments about heart health and physiology. Nora would rather fill her class schedule with band, she plays French horn, than participate in team sports in the gym.
There's an obvious divide in the kids that are going to be successful in those areas versus the ones that are not. And me personally being artistic, I'm not one of those kids that is on top of those things.
The rising sophomore at Wentzville's Timberland High School jumped at the opportunity to take gym online over the summer and not miss band or church camps. Nora is among nearly 300 students taking PE online this summer through Fueled by Launch at school districts across the St. Louis region. It's the first summer Launch has offered the course statewide. Nicole Lemon is the director of virtual programming for Launch. She says phys ed is the first course they developed for busy students or for those who...
Truly, the locker room is their worst nightmare for a variety of different reasons.
Christopher Hersel of Shape America, a nonprofit that promotes quality physical education, says online PE is another way to deliver those lessons. But he cautions they should be about more than simply tracking steps.
That would be like saying that I would be a great artist if I just sat down and drew 30 minutes a day, I wouldn't be. And if you could see me drawing, you would know that.
Hersel says good programs will involve feedback from instructors and interaction with peers. As for Nora, she's confident the course has developed a good exercise routine for after she has to return her fitness tracker back to school. I'm Ryan Delaney, St. Louis Public Radio.
Next on Statewide, The Crusher, Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin. Those are legends of pro wrestling, but have you heard of lowlife Christian Rose or Leader of the Pack? These are wrestlers you can see nearly every weekend in Northern Illinois. Now, if wrestling's not your thing, Dan Libman wants you to reconsider that. The author and NIU English teacher learned the hard way that it's a sport that's all about story. And he has his own story put together from member station WNIJ in DeKalb.
I have to confess something. I've been watching wrestling. Not recorded, but live. And not on a screen, but in the back of a sandwich shop. And not in a huge megalopolis like Chicago or Rockford, but in Oregon. Not the state, the city. Oregon, Illinois. I've been watching live wrestling in the back of a sandwich shop in Oregon, Illinois for a month now. But even that's not the confession. The confession is, I think I really love it. Almost a lot. And yet, when I tell people, my colleagues at NIU, my friends at Trivia, that I've been watching wrestling, they all say, well, you know, you're thinking it too.
Wrestling is fake.
And I try to defend it. You know what's fake, I'll say? Hamlet. Hamlet is totally fake. Same show every night. Hamlet gets into the ring with Laertes, sword fighting, killing, no improv, no audience participation, no one even gets body slammed. Hamlet is staged and scripted, but somehow that's legit and wrestling is fake? So let's try to figure this out. Is wrestling fake, real, or is it something else entirely? And to do that, I'm going to start at that sandwich shop. It's Scoops in Oregon, owned and operated by Andrew Carlson. This is the front of Scoops.
Hello.
This is the back. That's where Zawa Live happens. Zawa, or the Zen of Wrestling Academy, is the brainchild of Ryan Zishi. How did Ryan get to be in charge?
When you buy the ring, you own the company.
Before a recent match, I asked Ryan what goes into setting up an event.
Basically, for a show like this, you have to contact a venue owner. You have to have insurance. Obviously, you have to own the ring. It takes about 20 wrestlers per show. Usually, you have about 8 matches or so per show. And you got to get those organized and have some sort of sense of continuity and flow to it.
So all that effort to set up a match isn't fake. What about the matches themselves? Here's wrestler Stephen Wolf, a.k.a. Leader of the Pack.
When you first start out, like, people think like the ring's like a trampoline or something like that.
Yeah.
And that couldn't be farther from the truth. Like,
how does it make that noise, though? What's under there?
Basically, what's underneath there is metal beams that are crossed, and then there's 2x8s above those beams. Yeah.
So how does that not hurt?
Oh, it hurts.
Okay.
It's just like a football player getting tackled or like a hockey player getting hit. It's just one of the things you get used to after a while.
Okay.
Like, it sucks, but it definitely makes you realize if you really want it or if you really don't.
So the pain isn't fake. Must be the characters, the personas. Stephen Wolf is a hero, a baby face in the parlance of wrestling.
Coming up with the Leader of the Pack, for me, it's always been like, I love superheroes. And just kind of having that persona and being able to help people and have people cheer me on, that definitely gives me like the extra strength to like push the extra mile or do all the things that I do. Because without the people, I don't know what I would be able to do. So I always want to lead my pack.
So the persona is real. Guess I just happened upon the one real wrestler.
What's your
Savannah Stone.
Can I use your real name, or is it just rather go by those things?
Yes.
That actually is your real name?
Yeah.
Meet Lainey Luck and Savannah Stone, who took a moment to discuss their pre-match preparation.
A couple hours. I mean, you go to the gym, you get ready in the morning,
okay.
And then when you get here a couple hours before the show starts.
Okay.
You get everything figured out.
Yeah, just you come in, you gotta come up with your own individual strategy and see how, you know, the night plays out, really.
Okay.
You know, you come in with the plan, doesn't always work, but you just gotta go for it anyway.
How closely do you stick to the storyline or whatever?
Yeah, I always try to get a vibe of what the audience is. I mean, that's we do that for them, you know what I mean?
Right.
It's all about the audience, and so you try to vibe with them as much as they can and make them feel like part of the match, honestly.
Okay.
So,
trying to give them what they want. That's what we're here for.
What do they want?
Well, every crowd is different. You gotta find it. You gotta figure it out. That's the beauty in being able to work, is figuring out what your crowd wants.
Crowd response shapes the stories, and the wrestlers react. They don't do that in Hamlet. Ophelia's gonna drown every night, even if the audience is screaming for her to put on a life preserver. Must be the characters that are fake then, right, Lainey Luck?
It's honestly just an extension of me. Lainey is who I am, like, when I'm turned up. Lainey is too turned, and that's who I am when I'm too turned.
Okay. And the luck part is just...
Just people love alliteration.
I agree with that 110%. I think if you go out there pretending to be somebody you're not, you know, like I said, how do you connect with the fans? Okay. So you got to come out being yourself, you know. Maybe that's turned up if you're having a bad day. Use that in the ring, you know. Okay. That's just kind of what I do.
So, Lainey Luck in the ring is just a more turnt Lainey Luck. Savannah Stone is Savannah Stone at 11. Wonder how many Hamlets have been played by actual turnt princes of Denmark. Actually, it's probably happened once or twice, but still. And I hate to bring this up, but it's NPR, so what the heck. Lainey and Savannah perfectly encapsulate what sociologist Irving Goffman was talking about when he observed that people exaggerate certain parts of their personalities. He called it the dramaturgical perspective and said, quote, self is made up of the various parts that people play. In other words, all the world's a stage, as some phony baloney playwright put it, and all the men and women merely wrestlers. Wrestlers have a word for this, kayfabe. Think of kayfabe as reality, but turnt. I'll tell you more about kayfabe this afternoon. So the fights are real, the pain is real, the performers are real. Maybe a better question than, is it real, would be, why do it?
It's the crowd, man. You get that crowd behind you, and it's just the same reason a rock band goes out and plays in front of five people for $50. It's the love of it.
Finally, I just came right out and asked the boss, the guy who owns the ring, is wrestling fake?
I hate the word because it's
me too.
It discredits what training we put in, and if you anybody saw the amount of training we have to do this. And I would challenge anybody that says that it's fake, and I'm not trying to be old 80s tough guy here, but I would challenge anybody that says it's fake to come and fall directly on their back onto wood and metal. And that's all we do.
And somehow I ended up taking him up on that challenge. And not just fall backward, but do it from at least 6 feet off the ground, getting flung to the wood and the metal by another wrestler, my guru, low-life Christian Rose, babyface to my heel, in the ring for a battle to the finish, albeit a super brief one. Don't you dare not listen, or I'm coming for your tote bags.
Up next, Dan climbs into the ring. You don't want to miss that. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. Still to come, some of the reasons the state is behind when it comes to DNA testing in its crime labs. Patrick Smith will bring us some answers. That's ahead on Statewide. Still think professional wrestling is fake? Author and NIU instructor Dan Libman tried to dissuade you in his report on the Zawa Wrestling League in Northern Illinois, and now he'll risk life and limb to prove it's real and that it hurts. That's right, Libman's about to climb into the ring. First, he'll need a persona and appropriate attire.
On April 20th, 2019, lowlife Christian Rose won the Zawa Live Championship belt in a heart-stopping wrestling match against Bailey Bright. And yet, that might not have been the most anxious part of his evening. Because lowlife Christian Rose met another foe in the ring that evening, the bespectacled, handsome WNIJ librarian in a 2-minute, 30-second no-doubter.
The librarian's got a dirty face. What do you say we wash it off?
Lowlife Christian Rose isn't just a force of nature in the ring.
I'm the head trainer at the Zawa Zen of Wrestling Academy. I've been a wrestler for coming up on 13 years, I think. Yeah, it's been a long road.
He and Zawa head Ryan Zishi mentor young wrestlers at Z and She's, a dance studio in Rock Falls. And as a wannabe participatory journalist, I knew I would need a character.
It's the librarian. My big move is the book drop. And I'm going to take you out of circulation, is my catchphrase.
That's great. And that actually is good.
I see myself as the villain, so I'm taunting the audience like this. Shh.
There actually is a lot that you could do with that.
Okay.
I love the idea of, like, imagine you coming to the ring with, I don't know, War and Peace or some absurdly large book and being like, I need all of you to quiet down, and you start to read War and Peace. Okay. Maybe you're trying to like help the illiterate masses or whatever, if that's what the character views
I'm
the audience
snooty,
as.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, okay.
The power of reading. Somehow you're making literacy bad.
Christian and Ryan agreed to let me try my hand in the ring to experience the thing itself, So I watched and absorbed Christian's almost rabbinical utterances.
Because if two things collide, the softest thing has to give. Well, I would rather the energy and the force go into the ropes and the turnbuckles than a body.
On the day of our match, I asked low-life Christian Rose if I should be as nervous as I was.
I would say it would be bad if you weren't nervous.
Then Christian went to work setting up our match. Just minutes away from starting, Christian doped out a kayfabe version of our kayfabe event. You don't know what kayfabe is? You non-wrestling people who have never stepped foot on a mat, you can just assume it means basically the presentation of something staged as real or legitimate. In this case, lowlife Christian Rose and the WNIJ librarian were out kayfabing even the regular kayfabers.
Maybe you shush the crowd, they're booing you, then you get in my face and give me the big, you know, shh. And I say we would start hot at that point, and I'd just give you like a big punch.
Okay.
And then you add a little bit of character work, you add a little bit of shtick where it's like, ah, and yell real loud because it hurts or whatever. And I'm like, you said to be quiet.
Now how do we, when we actually film it, just pause and like do it, like how are we gonna do it?
I think we should just run it through live as if we're doing a match. So okay. I'll talk it out with you, it'll be super easy. I communicate in ring just fine. Imagine the Three Stooges.
Right.
If I kick you in the stomach and you just kind of bend down and go, ugh, well that's kind of lame. But if I kick the librarian in the stomach and he sells it as if Moe or Shem or Curly would,
right,
that's gonna get a better reaction. That's where the entertainment is.
I was pretty confident until the final thing Christian asked me before our match.
Is there any part of your body that's hurt? Like, do you have a bad back, bad knees or anything?
Not that it would have mattered. My friends were already in the crowd. I was going in the ring. I was wearing an NPR WNIJ shirt, compression bike shorts, knee pads, and cheating reader glasses perched on my nose. He took off his shirt. I shushed the crowd, taunted them, the most obnoxious librarian ever, and then lowlife Christian Rose hit me on the shoulder. The reading glasses went flying in one direction, my body went in another. I never thought about the crowd again. I held my own for several minutes, although video footage reveals it was only a couple seconds, and also I was not holding my own. I was being knocked around, flailing my arms like Buster Keaton, only slightly exaggerating. Soon Christian had knocked me against the turnbuckle and pulled my shirt up over my head and delivered the chop. The word chop has a genteel sound to it, as in pork chop, or I might give you a chop on the chest, which is what Christian said to me just before we started the match. This open-palmed chop hurt my ears as much as it did my chest, as his hand smacked my sternum, stinging like a belly flop, and leaving me with a deep purple bruise across my neck, which I was showing to horrified friends for days. It looked like I had been given a hickey by a shop vac. I forgot all my good lines. I'm gonna take you out of circulation. Here comes the book drop, all gone. I remembered to drop on all fours so I could trip him. This was supposed to be my turnaround when I get the momentary edge before the big climax. But when I planted myself, I was too close to the edge of the ring, which didn't give Christian any room to fall before hitting the turnbuckle. Christian set up again, whispering and reminding me to get more center before dropping on all fours. I did manage to trip him more convincingly, which is when the librarian's turnaround happened. I began to pummel him with an all-out violent punching assault. Actually, the truth is, even for a librarian, this looked pretty weak. So it was time for lowlife Christian Rose to finish me. He put his arm around my neck. I took his other arm and gripped. He grabbed my waist and lifted. Suddenly, I was upside down, hoisted over his head, upright. This is called a suplex. I was upside down, vertical, and 51 years old. Christian whispered, "Here we go," and then we were both in the air, spinning and dropping. He had told me if I landed with my arms in the wrong position, they could snap when we landed. But now that we were in free fall, both of us, I couldn't really tell which way was up or down. I also sort of didn't care. It was exhilarating, and it was fast. This moment of bizarre, glorious suspension lasted a second or two, and then that sound. Our bodies reclaimed by gravity, hitting the wrestling mat. And it was over. I had gone in the ring the WNIJ librarian, a clown, and 2 minutes and 30 seconds later, born on the back of low-life Christian Rose, I had crash-landed as a wrestler. Sort of, you know, kayfabe. Three beats later, he was declared the winner. The librarian had been crushed, but somehow, Dan Libman didn't feel like a loser. With the librarian's less than impressive 0-1 record intact, it was time to retire. I have hung up my WNIJ t-shirt and my fighting cheaters and can be found most afternoons in my public library, looking at magazines, drinking free coffee, and asking for help with the computers. I rarely think back to that glorious night when low-life Christian Rose Dewey decimated me, but occasionally, as I'm rereading War and Peace, I'll catch someone staring out of the corner of my eye, usually a child, staring, pretending to be too cool to notice me, working up their courage, until finally, politely, they will approach. "Excuse me," they whisper. "Are you the librarian?" I'll peer over my cheaters, give them a little wink. "I used to be," I'll say with a grin. "But I'm reading now, so shh."
You can read more about Dan Libman's venture into the wrestling ring. Find a link at statewideshow.com. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin is supporting legislation to roll back one of the provisions of the 1994 crime bill. The bill would restore Pell Grant eligibility to people incarcerated in both state and federal prisons. That means people in prison could get federal money to pay for college classes. Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines talked with Senator Durbin, the second highest ranking Democrat in the Senate, and why he supports this legislation.
Most of the men and women who are incarcerated will ultimately be released. And when they are released, there's an obvious question. Are they going to commit another crime, create another victim, or do something with their lives? We should start in the incarceration period assessing these prisoners and their future. And I joined in this legislation in the hopes that we can encourage training and education. We have found time and again that when people pick up a skill, become better educated in prison, they have a better chance to come out, not commit a crime, and have a good, positive life from that point forward.
You actually supported the 1994 crime bill, which, among other things, barred people in prison from receiving Pell Grants. Why was that?
It was probably the worst vote I ever cast. I'll bet you've never heard a senator say that. But it was a natural human reaction. We were facing this crack cocaine epidemic, and we were seeing real evidence that it was going to destroy certain parts of our society, and we overreacted. We came down hard, like a ton of bricks, and it failed. That war on drugs failed. Part of it was this terrible dilemma we faced, and they said, okay, you want to give Pell Grants to people in prison, then take them away from the kids who didn't go to prison. Well, that's a false choice, and it turns out that many of us voted to take the Pell Grants away from prisoners and look back on it and said, we're going to pay for that ultimately if people go back into prison after they've served their first term. So we've got to be more proactive and rehabilitative, and we've come around finally, both Democrats and Republicans, to believe that we've got to take a much different approach.
If Pell Grants are reinstated for people in prison, who should qualify to receive them?
We need to think this through. If for example, those who are serving time in prison would be admitted to a community college program that's being administered in that prison, then certainly compensating the community college and the professor teaching the course is a reasonable way to approach this.
So are we talking all incarcerated people or just those with nonviolent convictions?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm open to an approach, certainly, for those with nonviolent crimes, but let's be honest. People who have committed violent crimes, many of them, the vast majority of them, are ultimately going to be released at some point. When it comes down to it, there are certain things we might be able to do in that prison environment that really turns their lives around.
I'm curious how you get something like this passed in today's political climate.
Well, the good news is, kind of surprising news is, the bill I had for prison reform and criminal sentencing reform was actually signed by President Trump on December 22nd. Well, we put together a coalition, very conservative Republicans, Chuck Grassley, Mike Lee, and then I had my friend Cory Booker, a candidate for president, senator from New Jersey, and we teamed up, of all things, with Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law, whose father spent time in prison. So there's a growing bipartisan sentiment to look at incarceration and reducing crime in a different way.
That's Lee Gaines talking with Illinois Senator Dick Durbin about his support for legislation to restore Pell Grant eligibility to people in prisons. You're listening to Statewide. In 2016, a woman who we'll call Linda Johnson was raped by someone she knew. The man did not deny being there or that they had sex. Instead, he claimed it was consensual. She said it was not. Ultimately, he pleaded guilty, but it took almost 3 years for Johnson to get justice. Most of that time was spent waiting on DNA evidence to be tested, even though that evidence wasn't even necessary in this case. Patrick Smith takes the story from here.
Linda Johnson did not want to talk about her experience, but she agreed to let the court advocate who helped her through the legal process share the rough outline of her case, provided her identity was not revealed. Johnson's advocate, Mallory Littlejohn, says the DNA evidence was collected almost immediately after the assault, but it sat untested in state police custody for more than 2 years.
Nobody is going to do anything if DNA is pending, and so there aren't going to be any trials, there aren't going to be any plea deals, the case is just going to sit stagnant.
And so they waited. The hardest part of that long wait, Littlejohn says, was that the DNA wasn't even relevant to the case.
It almost defies logic because everybody in the room, the perpetrator, the cops, the state's attorneys, my clients, myself, we all know who the sex occurred with, and so the DNA is not going to help us.
Littlejohn is the managing attorney at the Chicago Alliance Against Sexual Exploitation. She says Johnson's case is typical of the cases she sees. Most sexual assaults are committed by someone known to the victim. Usually, their defense is consent.
DNA is never going to show whether or not the sex was consensual.
And yet, the cases drag on for years, with prosecutors waiting for irrelevant test results. And it has a big impact beyond individual survivors of sexual assault. There are more than 6,000 cases with untested DNA evidence in state police custody. Nearly 1,000 cases have been sitting untested for more than a year. Every time a case like Johnson's gets added, the backlog grows. The turnaround time gets longer. Brendan Kelly is the acting head of the Illinois State Police. It's his job to try and fix the DNA backlog.
Certainly there are issues within the laboratory system, and we're getting at that. But outside the lab, in the investigative process, in the court process, there are delays, but frankly are artificial.
Kelly says police and prosecutors need to be more selective with what they're submitting for testing in the first place. Before he took over the state police, Kelly was the top prosecutor in East St. Louis.
And I will tell you, from my time as a prosecutor, sometimes we are guilty of just saying, test everything, and then we'll see what happens.
Kelly says that approach might make sense when you're looking at an individual case, but it doesn't work with the realities of the justice system in Illinois.
Everybody wants to jump to the front of the line and have their case tested first, but we're going to have to develop a better management and a better way of triaging what those important things are.
The most recent report from the State Police Crime Lab shows almost 3,000 sexual assault and abuse cases awaiting DNA testing. Based on national statistics, in the vast majority of those cases, the question would not be whether sex happened or who was involved. The issue would be consent. Littlejohn says that means a lot of those cases are overburdening the crime lab for no good reason.
And it is not only the victim client that suffers, it's also the defendant that suffers. And other non-sex cases suffer when our criminal justice system is clogged up.
The Cook County State's attorney declined to be interviewed for this story. But in a statement, a spokeswoman says they cannot make decisions on whether to work up DNA evidence based on what they believe a potential defense might be. I've heard from defense attorneys who say they understand prosecutors' position, but Littlejohn says it doesn't make sense.
From my point of view, I don't see the logic.
Littlejohn says in many cases she's handled, police have videotaped statements with defendants admitting they had sex and claiming it was consensual, or text messages, or other evidence. And they have the testimony from the victim.
The law in Illinois is pretty clear that credible victim testimony is enough to secure a conviction.
In lots of other types of cases, prosecutors go to trial without DNA evidence. But with sexual assault, Littlejohn says, it's seen as an essential part of every case.
It's society. Society is the one who kind of buys into this monster myth that it's a stranger that jumps out. And that's when you need the DNA test to link the stranger to the sexual assault.
That means juries expect it, which means prosecutors don't feel comfortable going forward without it. It's a problem rooted in biases and unreasonable expectations. But Little John says considering the long delays and the impact it has on survivors, defendants, and the entire court system, police and prosecutors need to come up with solutions. They can't keep waiting for the state police to just test more and more DNA. Instead, they need to start making tough choices and go forward without it when they can. I'm Patrick Smith.
Stay with us for more on this story. Coming up after the break, we find out why advances in science have added to the DNA testing backlog. Stick around for more of Statewide. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A closer look at sexual harassment in Illinois, including results of a survey on the issue. That's just ahead. Right now, it takes Illinois State Police forensic scientists an average of 9 months to test DNA evidence. The long wait delays justice for victims, keeps defendants locked in jail, and makes it harder for police to solve crimes. The crisis is driven in part by scientific advances that have made it easier to collect DNA evidence. That sounds like a good thing, but it creates major problems for state crime labs and the justice system. Patrick Smith continues our story.
All right, come on in. All right, good morning. Everyone ready?
In April, Governor J.B. Pritzker toured the State Police Crime Lab in Chicago.
We know that unacceptable backlogs and issues with transparency have plagued this process for far too long.
Standing alongside him at the press conference after the tour was Illinois State Police Acting Director Brendan Kelly. Kelly has made reducing the state's backlog of untested evidence a priority since taking over the state police. But he wouldn't say how long that would take.
I think it's disingenuous to try to put some number out there. This is the date when it's going to happen. That is not being honest with people.
Kelly says part of the reason for that is that a lot of the backlog is driven by challenges that go way beyond crime lab resources. Some say it starts with a fundamental misunderstanding of when and how DNA evidence should be used. Brendan Max is the head of the forensic division for the Cook County Public Defender.
So we definitely, for years, fell into the misconception that DNA would solve a lot of the problems of the criminal justice system and make guilt or innocence a matter of science, and it hasn't turned out that way.
When most of us think of DNA evidence, we think of big, obvious samples, like a pool of blood or semen in a rape kit, instances where the connection to the crime is clear. But now we can get testable DNA from a few skin cells.
So as a result of that, what you have are crime scene investigators literally collecting every piece of debris. So if a crime happens in an alley, they're collecting every cigarette butt, every napkin, they're collecting every piece of trash around the area.
That means the amount of DNA evidence being submitted to the state police for testing has exploded.
The biggest problem is that this technology has become so sensitive that it's used too much on too many items of evidence. And because of that, we have a state lab that's not set up to handle that volume of traffic.
Max says that's created this funny situation where the DNA technology has gotten better and faster, but the delays in testing are getting longer. He says on average, they wait about 9 months or longer for DNA results from the state crime lab.
There are people in jail right now awaiting DNA results.
The frustrating thing, Max says, is that often they are waiting on test results that won't end up mattering at trial. The pool of blood at a murder scene is simple and straightforward. But a piece of trash in an alley is much less likely to be relevant to the case.
You end up having testing on sometimes dozens, sometimes hundreds of pieces of evidence in cases where we're pretty confident those items of evidence aren't going to have much probative value at all.
So the state crime lab is having to test all this useless DNA material that isn't really relevant. It means cases take longer and the backlog gets bigger. That might be a worthwhile trade-off if it helps even a little bit in the effort to solve the most important crimes like rape or murder. But it turns out a lot of the DNA evidence being submitted for testing is linked to nonviolent crimes. There are way more burglaries clogging up the state police crime lab than homicides. There were even 35 marijuana cases in the backlog earlier this month. Add it all up and you get a massive backlog that slows down the entire court system, including the most important cases like rapes and murders. cases take years to be resolved.
It does drag cases.
Adam Shepard is a criminal defense attorney. He works on a lot of cases with DNA evidence, but he says the backlog doesn't just impact cases waiting on test results. It slows down the whole court system.
Because the more a case is on a call, that's less time on that particular day that another case could be on the call. So now everything gets pushed back.
Still, Shepard says the advances in technology and the increased use of DNA evidence is a good thing for justice. And he says the solution to the backlog is simple. The state police need to hire more people or do whatever is necessary to test evidence faster. But Robin Woolery says it's not that simple. She's deputy director of the State Police Forensic Services Division.
Everybody has to work together in order to help solve these problems. It's not something that we're going to be able to do alone.
Woolery says the State Police Crime Lab is getting more cases than ever. With all the evidence coming in, the labs have to decide how to prioritize cases.
So the laboratory would first prioritize if a case is going to court. So if there's a court date, then that case is going to be expedited. So it's been pushed to the front of the list.
Does that mean that if we're going to court on a burglary, that those DNA tests would move up and bump down a stranger rape or something like that?
Well, if the case was going to court, that case would definitely become a rush. It would take a priority.
That means the more burglary cases submitted for testing before trial, the longer it takes for the lab to process more serious crimes in which the offender is unknown. A spokesman for the Chicago Police Department says the backlog hinders its ability to solve cases. He says there's a direct correlation between the time it takes to test DNA and the department's clearance rate. DNA test results could point police in the direction of a suspect, but if they don't come back for 9 months, it can be hard to put those leads to good use. Witnesses may have moved or stopped cooperating with police, or just not have the incident as fresh in their mind. Woolery from the State Crime Lab says to reduce the turnaround time, police and prosecutors will need to help reduce the amount of evidence being submitted for testing.
We are now making a concerted effort to talk with state attorneys about only requesting those most probative pieces of evidence.
A spokeswoman from the Cook County State's Attorney says prosecutors have an ethical duty to ensure they have all the evidence needed to get a conviction. She says they are aware of the state police backlog and resource problems, and that they have a team of specialists who help prosecutors decide what evidence needs to be tested before submitting it to the state police crime lab. Woolery says she believes prosecutors are starting to hear them when they caution against overtesting.
We try to get everybody to understand, hey, listen, if you have us work the pieces of evidence that are going to be most probative to your case, and we can get that information out to you quickly, this helps you in the long run with being able to get your evidence quickly, and the other five cases that you have waiting in line can get worked faster. But at the time, everybody's thinking about their one case and what they need.
In the meantime, Woolery says they are trying to address the problems on their end. They instituted a new case management system, and they've promised to hire 10 new trainees in the DNA section. Although so far, those jobs have not been posted. I'm Patrick Smith.
Yamasu recently produced a paper for the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute looking at sexual harassment in Illinois. She analyzed sexual harassment legislation in the state and a poll the institute performed in the fall on the issue. She recently spoke with Maureen McKinney.
I would say the most important thing that we found from doing that poll, we asked folks questions like, do you think that people have a better understanding of sexual harassment now than they did before? We asked, do you think people are more likely to be held accountable for sexual harassment or just as likely to be held accountable? And I think most importantly, we asked people if there was a candidate who was accused of sexual harassment by multiple people, would you still consider voting for them if you agreed with them on some of the issues? And we did not plan this, but interestingly enough, the poll was in the field during the week of the Kavanaugh hearings. So the poll was in the field from Monday, September 24th to Saturday, September 29th, and the Kavanaugh hearings were on Thursday, September 27th. And so I think for me, one of the things that I really pulled from looking at the poll was that there were a lot of partisan differences in how people think about sexual harassment throughout the state of Illinois, and the partisan differences that we noticed were pretty aligned with the way that the Kavanaugh hearings went and the results of that hearing. And so we noticed that a lot more Republicans endorsed that they would strongly consider voting for someone who had been accused of sexual harassment, that a lot of downstate voters also endorsed the same thing. And that makes sense because there tend to be more Republicans in those areas. And overall, people said, yeah, I think nowadays people have a better understanding of sexual harassment, or people are more likely to be held accountable. This gave us a really good snapshot about how people around the state are thinking about sexual harassment at a really critical time when it was very timely. And that was something that was in the news cycle a lot.
In terms of the other issues in the report?
As we're thinking about doing sexual harassment training, not only focusing on compliance-based training. And so at the beginning of the paper, I talk about all of the different ways that we know that training is most effective. So, you know, having a trainer come in person, really consider what is the climate of the workplace that I'm going to train people in? What are the issues specific to the people who work in this environment? What is the culture of the workplace now? And what is the culture that we hope to build? And how can we shift it in that direction? And so I think a lot of times sexual harassment training sort of becomes one of the run-of-the-mill trainings that people maybe do online or, you know, do in like a 45-minute session, and then it never gets talked about again. And so I think one of the things that I think is really important is how can we think about training from a perspective of shifting culture, you know, and changing the way that people interact with each other in the workplace as it relates to gender, as it relates to sexual harassment, as opposed to sort of putting it, you know, on a checkbox and saying, well, the law requires us to do a training once a year. And so now we've done the training and that's all. That's the last we're ever going to talk about it. And so thinking about what it actually means to create a workplace where different people feel valued and different people feel welcomed and don't feel like they're being exposed to harassing behavior. And that might be more difficult than a 45-minute training, that'll take a lot of effort on many different people's parts for the culture to shift in a way where harassment isn't prevalent anymore. One of the things that we really highlighted was that Illinois was one of the first states to pass legislation on sexual harassment within state government. And so as of right now, since 2017, 12 laws have been passed on curbing sexual harassment in state government. So this includes things like training. This includes extending the statute of limitations on harassment complaints. You know, after folks said, you know, sexual harassment is a problem around the country, but it's a problem in Illinois.
Is there anything in your studies that shows how Illinois stands compared to other states?
Yeah, so Illinois was actually one of the first states to really pass any type of legislation on sexual harassment and on specific training requirements. So, and I think compared to other states, Illinois stacks up pretty well. I know as of like 2017, Maine has had the most strict training requirements, and Illinois is taking some steps to really mirror those policies as well. Like, you know, employers, so like in Maine, anyone who employs 15 people or more has to do sexual harassment training. And so that was one of the most strict on the books, and Illinois is taking some steps to start to mirror.
The other question I wanted to ask is, what do you think more can be done?
For us, or at least as far as the Institute goes, we sent copies of the report to members of the General Assembly. The Simon Review is really widely distributed to media outlets, to legislators, to professors. And so I think what we're hoping is that this really helps continue the conversation and continue the momentum that has already been built. And so we're hoping that, you know, other scholars pick this up and continue to do research on sexual harassment. We're hoping that members of the General Assembly look at this info as a guide to make, you know, making future changes in legislation in Illinois regarding sexual harassment. We hope that members of the public see, you know, the paper on the Institute's website because it's free and available to the public, and maybe start conversations about what does this issue mean in my workplace? You know, even if I don't work in the public sector, how does this issue impact me personally? And so I think that our hope is that as this has been a conversation over the last several years, and increasingly so as more women are being sworn in to public office, thinking about how we can continue in, you know, public sector spaces and private sector spaces, academic spaces and legislative spaces, really continue talking about and thinking about how to curb sexual harassment.
Shea Masu talking with R. Maureen McKinney. That does it for this edition of Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again next time for more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com and also find our podcast on the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois public radio stations.